Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States has the largest prison population in the world. 2.3 million people are currently behind bars in federal prisons, state prisons, local jails, juvenile correction facilities, and Indian country jails, according to the Prison Policy Initiative. People are in jail by the thousands for no other reason than they are poor. When the DOJ investigated police practices in Ferguson, Missouri, it found that massive fines and fees are levied for minor crimes like broken taillights and rolling through stop signs. And when the poor can't pay, they are subjected to an epidemic of repeated stays in jail. In his new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, one of today's guests, Peter Edelman, writes that Ferguson is everywhere in the United States today. People who can't pay their fines are forced into debt or worse. Some are jailed. Some jails charge inmates for the stay. Others get their driver's licenses revoked and obviously can't get to their jobs without risking criminal charges for driving without a license. A criminal record can bar someone from getting a job or getting housing. And then there are heavily policed schools and zero tolerance policies. And they mean that poor kids and kids of color have a much higher chance of having a record. And the list goes on and on. Peter Edelman explores these and other elements of a justice system that criminalizes poverty in the U.S. Peter Edelman is professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at the Georgetown University Law Center. He was a top advisor to Senator Robert Kennedy from 1964 to 68 and went on to fill various roles in President Bill Clinton's administration before he resigned in protest over the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. His new book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. And Peter Edelman joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. In the book, Peter Edelman writes that public defenders are the first line of defense in protecting low-income people and people of color from high fines and fees. The presence of a defense attorney can often avert an injustice. Today, we are joined in studio by Brendan Woods, the first Black public defender of Alameda County. He's got more than 20 years of experience in criminal defense litigation. Brendan Woods is also president of the California Public Defenders Association. Hi, Brendan. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And Peter and Brendan, I know you also have egregious examples of people who've rolled through stop signs, for example, and now are in major debt. And I think first it's important to talk about what it means to criminalize being poor and address this common opinion and conception people have that those who are in jail are criminals being punished. Can you take that one first, Peter?
Well, the answer is it's not true. Unfortunately, of course, there are people who commit crimes that are we need to have civil have it work in our community and make sure that it's safe for people. But that's not what this is about. What happened here, going back to the Reagan era, but really grown up a lot more just since 2010. 48 states have increased their fines and fees just since 2010. This is about raising revenue. Grover Norquist once said that we should get the get it all how much we spend on things down into the you can drown people on the bathtub that government will become so small. And so what happened in the 80s is that especially the court systems, but really the governments, like in Ferguson, started looking for other ways to get money. And one of the places they turned in a very big way was not taxing people as they should, but arresting them over and over again, and when they can't pay, very often throwing them in jail. And so that's what we have. It's really from the anti-tax rebellion.
In your book, Peter, you write that mass incarceration, which has victimized people of color from its beginning in the 70s, set the scene for the new criminalization of poverty. But to understand the new impulse to make being poor a crime, one has to follow the trail of tax cuts that began in the Reagan era, which created revenue gaps all over the country. Deep budget cuts ensued, and the onus of paying for our justice system began to shift to, quote, the users of the courts, including those least equipped to pay. Brendan, can you talk about that? Because this is one topic that doesn't come up when we talk about the system, how it's exploded, and reform. Just this argument that Peter makes about, you know, taxes are one, tax cuts are one big reason why we got here.
Yeah, I think Peter is spot on. He's very well versed with regard to talking about the historical context. But the way we see it on the ground from the public defender lens, there's a system that's been built and created, and it derives off what I'm going to call human capital. The system exploits low-income people of color. Those are primarily everyone we represent. And you can't begin to have this conversation without looking at the amount of people that are currently incarcerated simply because they can't afford to bail out. I think our pretrial rate right now hovers around 70%. So 70% of people who are currently in custody are there pretrial. They have not had their cases adjudicated. They have not been convicted of a crime, and they're sitting behind bars. And the way that breaks down based on race, based on income, is absolutely astonishing. We've got this bail industry right now that is making, I think, in the range of $14 billion annually. There are only two countries in the world that have a profit bail system. It's the United States and the Philippines. And as you've mentioned, our incarceration rate is the highest, the highest in the world. And you've got to have this conversation, and you've got to begin looking at the bail industry. And then on top of that, there's this vicious cycle, because once you are convicted of a crime, whether it be a low-level offense or a felony or misdemeanor, there are all these fines and fees that are attached. And I can go through those later, but it's just one simple conviction can cause you to be in debt for thousands of dollars.
We've got the element of tax cuts, and like you said, Brendan, there's this whole system which also deserves a lot more attention. One of the key quotes I thought in your book, Peter, came from Jack Cowley, who's a retired warden living in Oklahoma, and he told the New York Times a couple years ago, "It's hard for me not to be cynical about it. Think about the size of our system, all the judges and the lawyers putting their kids through college, people that make tasers. Crime is driving the train," which of course you can argue with, but his point is, this is a massive business that is too big to fail.
It absolutely is. It is in almost every state. You have the numbers we have are that there are 10 million people in the country who owe a court debt one way or another. That the amount that's owed is $50 billion. It's throughout the criminal justice system. At the beginning, when somebody gets brought in on some very minor thing, then they may be thrown in jail when they can't pay for the fine. That's unconstitutional. Or a payment plan, and one way or another, they get hooked if they, as happens in state after state, lose their driver's license, then people understandably have to drive anyway, and so they get arrested again, and the amount owed, and it goes into the thousands and thousands of dollars. So it absolutely is just a business, and a huge one.
There's the for-profit prison industry. Prison vendors have conferences every year. And then to your point, Brendan, about the bail system, Jonathan Smith is also quoted in Peter's book. He was head of the Special Litigation Section of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. DOJ. And he said, in New Orleans, for example, the bail system is what makes the whole corrupt system work. The bondsmen went to the state legislature and got them to add 3% to the regular 10% bail fee, which is then divvied up among the court, the prosecutor, the defender, and the jailer, which means that everyone has skin in the game.
Yes, and that's part of the issue.
How does that work here in California?
With regards to the bail fees? No, I am not sure how it works exactly. I don't believe that our office gets any revenue from bails, and I haven't seen it. If it does, and that would be actually sounds like an inherent conflict of interest. Mm. I do want to talk with regards to that because I'm not sure people really understand or see how it plays out in a real-life criminal case. And I want to give an example of a case that we've had where a client of ours was charged with sexual assault, and this client happened to be white. He did not have resources, but his family had resources. So his family was able to bail him out. Mm-hmm. We had ample time to investigate the case, to pursue every avenue. We had a great lawyer assigned to the case, and she worked it up extremely well. That lawyer was able to put pressure on the DA and force him to turn over evidence that was exculpatory. That client had his case dismissed. So if we were to flip that around and put one of our clients that we normally represent, who is a low-income person of color, they would not have been able to afford the bailout. They would have been stuck in custody. The prosecutor would have come to them with a deal. She said, we can release you. You might have to plead to a strike, but you can get out in a month or 2 months. The client would have resolved his case, and then we see how that would have affected him. He would have had a felony conviction. He would have had to pay $1,000 in fines. He would not be able to find employment. He would be on felony probation, so any simple violation would have sent him to prison. And so we see how the cycle plays into each other, into itself, and it feeds itself, and it just it's really, really vicious.
And this is
Let me talk a minute. Could I just
talk, Peter,
about the bail in a little different way, just to add to that? It's a weapon to take in money. The particular thing in Louisiana is a little bit unusual, getting that extra bump of money to divide, as you explained it. But the usual thing, if you look at Rikers Island and jails around the country, the judge throws them in there. They can't pay the bail, as Brendan said. And then the only way that they can get out is to plead guilty, because the family can't pay. And then they owe the money. They have a payment plan, and that's where they're hooked. It's through the bail is the entry point to get all of this money that then piles up when they can't pay the payment plans. And when they can't make a payment on what they do owe, they get another whole criminal contempt for not having paid, and they owe more money. And that's why we talk about it going really, they can never get out from under it. And the other piece that you talked about a minute ago, I just want to give you a couple numbers on all of this for-profit stuff. And it isn't just the people who do the private things to get money for themselves. It's also the states and localities. So 41 states charge for a room and board when you're in prison. And 44 states charge for probation and parole. 49 states charge for electronic bracelets. So almost all of the states in the country charge for all of these things, even without the for-profit aspect of it. So again, it tells you what huge business this is. Mm.
What is the status of bail reform here in California, Brendan? It was getting a lot of attention last year because some of California's top judges were in favor of it. But I understand that it hit a lot of roadblocks in the California State Assembly.
Sure, yes. Yeah. So the bail reform, SB 10, well, there were two bills that were put forth, AB 42 and SB 10. AB 42 was Bonta's bill, and SB 10 was Hertzberg's bill. And bail reform right now has a lot of momentum in California, and it took some pushing and effort from the organizers to really get a group of people behind it. Excuse me. So the governor appears to be now in support of bail reform. The Supreme Court justice is now in support of some sort of bail reform, and so there is still momentum. And if you think about bail and the way it's structured, and we are all realizing this now, money bail doesn't make anybody safer. It doesn't make any community safer. Someone's freedom should not be based on the amount of money they have. It should not be determined by their wealth. It should be based on whether they are a risk to the community or not. And we have so many clients who are simply in custody because they just can't afford bail. And what they do, as Peter said, they take plea bargains to get out of custody.
And in custody for doing what?
Oh, there's a whole gamut. I mean, we have cases where there are fairly low-level thefts. They have a record. They could be in custody. There could be a drug possession. There could be there's a whole gamut up to robbery and more serious crimes. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are in custody for all sorts of crimes, mm-hmm.
and things they didn't do.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to get to, Peter. Thank you. There's this presumption of innocence that's supposed to exist in our system, but there are so many people who are in custody on low-level offenses that really don't get that. They are, in some ways, presumed guilty and then placed in custody, and they have to assert their innocence, and that's not the way the system should be built.
And in Alameda County, because that's where you work, Brendan, Peter says that public defenders are the first line of defense for low-income people and people of color. What is it like in Alameda County? With the people that you're talking about, do they all have access to a public defender?
Yes. Everyone who cannot afford an attorney has access to a public defender, our office, or to get a court-appointed attorney if we have the conflict. So, yes, they all have access, and we are now trying to get to them at the earliest point in their case. When they come in for arraignment, we try to represent them at the first stage of their case right now.
And as you point out, Peter, that is not the case in other parts of the country.
You took the words out of my mouth. The Constitution says, the famous Gideon case says on the criminal side, it's not true on the civil side, by the way, that you're supposed to have a lawyer. But you can go a lot of places in this country, particularly in smaller communities, and they're either not there at all, or there's somebody on a contract who can't possibly reach everybody and help them. And some of them are contracted with the judge, and they're really in the judge's lap and actually do what the judge wants and really don't represent the defendant.
On bail reform, Brendan, what would this do in California?
Sure. So bail reform is still in its process right now, and the issue is going to be seeing what form and what shape SB 10 finally ends up in. But as it is right now, at a bare minimum, it will make a large portion of the low-level misdemeanors, they will not be held on bail. They'll be released. Bail reform is going to rely on some sort of pretrial risk assessment tool, and there will be some people who have some sort of conditions based on their release, based on how they score on that test. But at a minimum, it's looking at focusing on taking a large group of misdemeanor cases and allow them to be released without bail.
Brendan Woods is the first African-American public defender of Alameda County. He's got more than 20 years of experience in criminal defense litigation. We're also joined by Peter Edelman. His latest book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter is professor of law and public policy and the faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality at the Georgetown University Law Center. He worked under the Clinton administration and resigned in protest over the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. And we'll talk about that later in the show. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you have been affected by this system, we would love to hear from you. If you'd like to share your story, you can be anonymous if you'd like. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you work on issues of reform, we'd love to hear from you. What laws stand out in your community? We were talking about the bail earlier, and I just want to talk about the case of Kalief Browder. I mean, you know, just reading about Kalief again,
yes,
it is just still so shocking. I mean, this is just one of the most horrific cases, and I think for the first time, a lot of people, because of Kalief Browder, learned about how this bail system works. And I just want to read from your book, Peter. 16-year-old mm-hmm. Khalif Browder was locked up for 3 years at Rikers Island in New York City, waiting for a trial on a crime he did not commit simply because he could not make bail. Khalif Browder's ordeal epitomizes the inequality of our bail system and the way it contributes to the criminalization of poverty. As Jennifer Gonerman recounts in a series of heartbreaking articles in The New Yorker, Khalif Browder was arrested in 2010, accused of stealing a backpack, which probably never happened. He said he didn't do it, and then sent horribly for a 16-year-old to Rikers Island. Because the alleged crime occurred in the Bronx, his case was handled in an unbelievably overcrowded, understaffed court with a docket that is years behind. Without asking about his family's financial circumstances, a routine omission, the judge set bail at $3,000 because he was already on probation from a previous guilty plea to a joyride and a stolen delivery truck. How common is it for the system not to ask about the family's financial circumstances?
Well, around the country, it's quite regular. The basis. There's litigation going on now, including in San Francisco, that gets to that exact thing, arguing that it's unconstitutional not to ask whether a person who's not otherwise a risk. And so that's a part of why they get stuck there. The argument, which has been successful, particularly in a major case in Houston, Texas, where the whole system in Harris County down there was ruled to be unconstitutional, it was because the judges were not asking whether a person was actually able to pay that, and therefore you have this gap between rich and poor. So that's the heart of the reform that we need. That we use recognizance, that people don't stay there, particularly on these minor things, and instead they get out. And there's a lot of, by the way, experience that shows that when you put people out in the community and you give them the notice, they come. They come to for their trial. So what you're discussing, by the way, in California now with SB 10, that's already been done in a number of states. New Jersey, interestingly, Chris Christie, but also Maryland and Kentucky and Colorado. So we can look to these things. The Arnold Foundation is the one that developed the algorithm that is the basis for making good decisions about who gets to get out. And it's not only been developed, used, and is now being used in a number of states, but in actually dozens of municipalities, counties around the country. So we know that the reformed approach works. I hope California is ready to move on this. It's a very sound step to take.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll talk more about Khalif Browder's case after the break. But just quickly, Brendan, why is this bail reform hitting, not going anywhere in the assembly? I mean, why did it hit a block in the assembly, hit a wall in the assembly?
It was about agreement. I mean, this is change, and people are often uncomfortable with change. It's about change, in some ways, accountability. So judges can easily rely on a bail system to keep people in. Now they have to make, in some ways, use their discretion to make some judgment calls, and they are forced to a different way of thinking. And maybe that's a little bit of accountability on their part that they might not want to take, but now they're going to have to. And behind that, we forget there's this massive, massive force called the bail industry, and they are extremely well-funded, and they are going to fight this tooth and nail. So we have to think about all that in context, and that's why it's stalling a little bit. But there are so many advocates around the table that are pushing this really hard. ACLU, SC Justice Group, Ella Baker Center, California Public Defender Association, and there are some assembly members and senators who can see that this is something that needs to happen.
On today's Your Call, we are talking about the criminal justice system and what reforms are working and what is on the table. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Turkey's military assault on the Kurdish enclave of Afrin in Syria. The attack has displaced more than 5,000 people. 30 have been killed. We will also look at the future of the DREAM Act in light of the budget negotiations. And we'll talk about the San Francisco Board of Supervisors' decision to replace Acting Mayor London Breed with Mark Farrell as a caretaker until the June 5th election. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcall@kalw.org. It's yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about the criminal justice system in this country. The U.S. has the largest prison population in the world. 2.3 million people are currently behind bars. 1 in 5 are there because of drug offenses. People are in jail by the thousands for no other reason than they are poor. We're talking about this with Peter Edelman, author of the new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. He resigned when he worked under the Clinton administration in protest over the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. We're also joined by Brendan Woods, the first African-American public defender of Alameda County. He's got more than 20 years of experience, and he's president of the California Public Defenders Association. I wanted to continue talking about Kalief Browder because it is just such a horrific story. When Kalief Browder was at Rikers, he was abused by guards and inmates. That was captured on video. He spent 2 of his 3 years, 800 days, in solitary confinement, and he tried to commit suicide several times. Very sadly, after he was released, he did commit suicide. Brendan, I mean, when this story came out, and again, The New Yorker did amazing reporting, I mean, people were just shocked about what happened to a 16-year-old who was accused of stealing a backpack.
Yeah. The story is, in some ways, a complete failure of our quote-unquote justice system, or something. So you might want to say it's the way it's designed to work. But what happened to this young man? You know, I've never met him. I've never met the attorneys. I've just read about it, and it is appalling and shocking to think that someone, a 16-year-old kid, could be in custody in an adult jail for that amount of time. And so I always think about the Browder case, and I've kind of narrowed it down to 5 issues. Number one that we've already talked about is cash bail. If cash bail was not in existence, he would not have had to endure that cruelty that he suffered at Rikers. And then when we think about his age, that's issue number two, he was 16. There's no way a 16-year-old should be in an adult jail. The law needs to be changed with regards to what is a juvenile in New York. It should be 18 and over for adult court. And then their speedy trial system. There really is, in effect, no right to a speedy trial in New York. I mean, they say there is, but it's continuance upon continuance upon continuance, and it's determined by whether a DA is ready to go or not. So people languish in jail for years, like the Browder case. And then finally, or two more issues, is the enforcement. The enforcement by the police, the prosecution by the district attorney. This case was weak in and of itself. It had holes in it. And if he wasn't a low-income person of color, he would not have been prosecuted in the manner in which he was. Mm-hmm. And finally, counsel. In Peter's book, he talks about public defenders and counsel. It is necessary and essential to have effective counsel to push back against what happened to this young man. So,
well, we want to play a clip from an ABC documentary that was done on Kalief Browder.
Court records show Kalief had attempted suicide at least 6 times, spent 1,110 days behind bars, more than 800 of those in solitary confinement. His court date postponed more than 30 times. He endured all this, having never been given a trial, never convicted of a crime. Finally, in June of 2013, all charges against Kalief were dismissed. But his experience exposed a troubled criminal justice system and the brutality of life behind bars.
I think at some point, almost a reckless disregard by the prosecutors in this case. They didn't care, Byron. They saw his file. They saw that he was in jail. And he'd probably take a plea. And they were hoping he'd take a plea.
The judge told me that if I plead guilty, I would be released from jail that same day. But I didn't do it. You're not going to make me say I did something just so I could go home.
When we first met him, November of last year, he was doing better, he said. Earned his GED, started classes at Bronx Community College, pulling a 3.56 GPA. But the psychological trauma from jail had taken its toll.
And when he first came home, he would just walk the four corners of the driveway.
You hear animals do that have been confined to a space.
Yes, he did it. And I had to watch my baby go through all of that.
In the last year, Khalif grew depressed, deeply paranoid.
You know, deep down, I'm a mess. I feel like I'm a grown old man.
And then two Saturdays ago, 2 years after his release from jail, Khalif Browder hanged himself with an air conditioner cord in his home in the Bronx.
And that is a clip from an ABC documentary about Khalif Browder. The New Yorker, again, did excellent reporting on this. But when that came out, Brendan, the one thing I was thinking about is how many other Khalif Browders are out there that we have not heard about and will never hear about?
Thousands, millions. There are so many. And in some ways, what's unique about Khalif's case is that he had the fortitude to push the case also and say he's not guilty and then not resolve his case. And that doesn't happen as often as maybe it should. But you could understand why, because in order for him to, I guess, prove his innocence or not be convicted, he had to endure such a hardship and pain and suffering by being locked up in a cage. And remember, that is what we do in this country. We take human beings and lock them in cages. And it's just a travesty. It really is.
And let me tell you about one of the things that has happened in the wake of that tragedy, because it certainly had awakened people all over the country. I mentioned the lawsuit in Houston. As a result of getting the preliminary injunction in Harris County, earlier last year, 6,000 people have gotten out of jail there because the judge ruled that it was unconstitutional, and therefore those people were being held unconstitutional. 6,000 people, 1,500 in Cook County in Illinois. So we're moving. We've got to do a lot more, but that's what can happen with good lawyering and attacking the structure of it as well as representing individuals.
Peter Edelman is author of the new book, Not a Crime to be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. He's professor of law and public policy at the Center on Poverty and Inequality at the Georgetown Law Center. Brendan Woods is the first African-American public defender of Alameda County and president of the California Public Defenders Association. And today we are talking about the massive prison system in this country and how so many people, mostly people of color and low-income people who even roll through a stop sign can find themselves in major debt, in some cases, can end up in jail. And if you have a comment or a question, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Alan in Berkeley. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. I just was calling to see if the Constitution's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, being that punishment the Supreme Court deems cruel but not unusual, or deems unusual but not cruel, that's imposed by government, state government, or whatever body, is likely to be upheld, all other things being equal, or if that's too simple a way of looking at it, because that would be kind of disturbing if they thought it's cruel but it's not unusual. It passes muster with the Supreme Court. Please just say whatever you wish. Thank you for a great show.
I always tell my students that there's the Constitution as it's read by the Supreme Court, 5-4 sometimes, and what you and I might think, which might be quite different. So in terms of how the Eighth Amendment through the 14th Amendment is interpreted, that idea hasn't, at least to this date, become a factor in this. What is, and when I talk about there's 12 of these cases pending around the country, in the Houston one, which actually has this partial result, it's about equal protection. It's about the fact that there is this gap, between rich and poor, and the rich can get out, and the poor who can't pay it's just absolutely, if you will, arbitrary. And so that's the theory. And so far in these cases, it's showing success.
Well, thank you for calling, Alan. Let's go next to Mike in El Cerrito. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show. Do we have Mike? Let's go to Selassie in Oakland, one of the Frisco Five hunger strikers who protested police brutality. Hi, Selassie. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Rose. How you doing? Thank you for taking my call. And, you know, I'm a big fan, so I'm listening to you while I'm in the Bay.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, you know, being in jail is really traumatizing. You know, I've been fortunate to be one of the only black men that I know that hasn't been to the penitentiary. But I've been to the county jail on a few different stints. And for trumped up charges, not doing something, you know, before the marijuana laws were so relaxed, you know, it was a big thing to have marijuana and then go to jail for a few months or a few weeks. And the isolation of being in jail and the traumatization, the psychological trauma of not being able to leave when you want, being told when to go to the bathroom, being told when you get up, you know, you get up at like 4 a.m. People don't know the experiences of jail. And they wake you up at 4 a.m. Sometimes they come in and traumatize you and wake, you know, I'm still traumatized and I haven't been to the county jail in maybe 15, 20 years.
Wow.
Since I was a young man. But I still am traumatized with that. So anybody who's ever been, it's so hard to imagine being a civilian like that. But if you ever get unlucky to do a crosswalk walk or don't pay a bill and get a warrant and you go to jail like for a week, it will change your life.
Mm. You know, Selassie, you bring up such a good point because we talk about these horrific cases. We throw out the numbers. According to the Prison Policy Institute, every year, 11 million people go to jail, go in and out of jail. 641,000 people walk out of the prison gates. What about that, Brendan? Just the trauma of being in a jail.
Yeah, and I got to thank Selassie for the call. I don't think the general public realizes what it means to be incarcerated and how demeaning it is and how it is just the impact it has on your life and your family's life, and have someone while you're in jail tell you every single thing you have to do, when you can go to the bathroom, when you can change. It is, and strip searches, it is so demeaning. And when we think about some of the offenses that people are in custody for, and I think about their previous comment, their caller's comment about cruel and unusual punishment, think about being in jail for, let's say, 5 to 10 days for driving on a suspended license. That is insane. Thinking about being in custody for a petty theft, that is insane. Thinking about possibly serving a life prison, which I have one of these cases, a life prison for stealing CDs, you know, doing a first-degree burglary, that is insane. So we as a nation have to rethink incarceration. We have to rethink punishment. There's so much more work that we still have to do. And I think bail, fixing that, is just the beginning.
Three strikes, or stealing CDs, life in prison. Was this under the three strikes law in California?
Yes.
Let me just say on the 11 million, just so we finish that thought, 700,000 people every day are in the jails, and 450,000 of that 700,000 are not guilty of anything. They're waiting to be tried. 450,000. So just to add to what we've said, and among other things, if we do this in a just way, guess what? We save money.
You know, we did a show last week talking about Homeboy Industries, which is an amazing organization in Southern California that helps people when they get out of jail. And Greg Boyle, who runs it, said, in L.A. County, this massive county, there are very few resources for people who get out of jail. For someone like Selassie, who's still dealing with trauma 15 years after the fact, I mean, Brendan, are there any resources available for someone like Selassie?
There are more resources coming online now. I think there's more of a conversation about this, and there are some organizations in Oakland. I think we've got a fairly strong base of community-based organizations that are there for our returning citizens, and they're able to provide services to them, counseling, and healing circles, which are really critical. And there's this whole new movement towards restorative justice, and I can't really speak enough about that and how that has the potential to change the mentality of our clients and also change the mentality of the victims and how they view our clients.
We have a question about restorative justice. Let's hear from Janet in San Francisco. Hi, Janet. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. When I went to a city-to-city tour of New York, we went to the Red Hook Court, which is a pioneer in restorative justice, trying to avoid all the injustices that your speakers are talking about. And there's a very active movement of restorative justice I know of in San Francisco and in Sonoma County. What do the speakers know about this, and has it been tried in your areas of work?
Well, Red Hook I know about, and I've been there. And as you said, the caller said, it's a model for the country. We just need to do that, get other jurisdictions to do that. And that's the sensible way to handle these things instead of throwing people in jail and holding them in the whole bail thing. It's a way of really not using the system, the traditional system, but really giving people a chance through community justice and through restoration and justice. So it's really important. People should take a look at it.
So we have a restorative justice program that's run pretty well in our juvenile division, and it's had some great impact on the lives of our juveniles. I think it could be expanded and we could do more. And we're now in the process of trying to replicate that model in adult court. So we are moving towards that direction now.
What do we expect under the Trump administration? Attorney General Jeff Sessions recently revoked 25 legal guidance documents, including an Obama-era letter urging state and local judges not to impose fines and fees in a way that locks poor people into cycles of debt in prison. I mean, what do we expect under Jeff Sessions, Brendan?
I think Peter's laughing there. I'm trying to say this delicately. Maybe I just shouldn't. All hell. I mean, I almost can't. The impact, unfortunately, that Sessions and President Trump are going to have on the criminal justice system long term can be devastating. Mm. And I'm not sure if people are paying attention, but they should be paying attention to the amount of judges that this president is going to appoint, many of them to lifetime terms, and he has the potential to change the Supreme Court justice makeup, the Supreme Justice Court, and it's going to be devastating. And if we look at the amount of, for lack of a better term, white men who were simply unqualified to do the job that he's putting in these positions, it is absolutely terrifying. Mm. Terrifying. And it's going to take a generation to overcome that. And if we look at the way they're enforcing or threatening to enforce marijuana laws, immigration, it just keeps coming. And in a system, it's a rough time right now.
Peter, what would you add?
I would certainly, number one, completely agree, sad to say. But what I would add is that particularly in this area of fines and fees and bail, the action, what the federal government did and the Obama administration, both with the litigation, bringing cases, and also these guidances that you mentioned, the 25 guidances. There was also one on juvenile as well as the adults. So two of the 25 are what we're talking about today. But the action, apart from getting these horrible judges and some other things, the action is mostly at the state and local level. And so what I would add is that we are seeing momentum, that we are seeing change. You're seeing it in California. We've talked about Alameda. There's some terrific things going on in San Francisco. There's something that I didn't know about that's called the Director of Financial Justice in San Francisco. You probably know about it, and Stoldreyer. And we see this, even after I wrote the book, I've gone around to the country, and I see that the driver's license suspension, for example, is in just about every state. But on the other hand, you've got lawsuits that that are moving along in the right direction to say that's unconstitutional in Tennessee and Michigan. You've got Mississippi that gave back driver's licenses, 100,000 people in Mississippi on their own without even anybody suing them. And as we go through all of these things, we see state legislatures, not just in California. We need to keep that momentum up. But the fact is that we have lawyers, and they've begun to partner with pro bono lawyers and private firms to make these lawsuits. We've got many more chief justices around the country are now seeing how terrible making people poorer with these fines and fees and how the bail system works. So that's the other side of it, is that we have momentum. It certainly slows us down because of what Trump will do and what the administration isn't, the Obama administration isn't there to do. But we really are moving in the right direction. And it's the whole system, 2.2 million people, everything that we've talked about, that's an enormous task. But you have Prop 47 in California. You did that. The people of California did that. And we have Lenora Anderson, who's you probably know, who's now doing that, working toward doing that in a number of states. So I always want to take a look at what we can possibly achieve, even when it's very difficult.
We have an email from a listener who says the mass incarceration is part of the party platforms for both Republicans and Democrats. Socialists, Greens, Libertarians are against the prison industrial complex. If you support Republicans and Dems, this is what you're voting for. And Brendan, I just wonder what you think about what's happening here in California, you know, often referred to as the state of resistance. Peter writes that in his book that California is the leader and all-time champion in taking away driver's licenses. As of 2015, more than 4 million Californians had lost their license for some kind of fine they didn't pay on time, often for an infraction that had nothing to do with driving. Californians have fought back against this. But what do you think? I mean, the Dems are in power in this state. How are the Democrats doing on these issues?
They have been pushing some issues, and I think recently, as Peter's commented, there's been some good laws that have been passed, particularly in California. For example, going specifically to the driver's license, just this year, AB 103 passed, which ended the suspension of driver's license for failure to pay fines, for traffic fines. So you can see how there's that cycle. Once you fail to pay your traffic fine, your license gets suspended and you can't work. So they've passed legislation right now to fix that. They also passed SB 190, which eliminated the juvenile fee. So for kids who went through the juvenile system, there used to be a fee for the attorney, a fee to probation for supervision. They've eliminated those fees. So California is moving in the right direction, especially when it comes to the criminalization of the poor. But there is still just a lot of work that needs to be done still. We think about bail reform. That has got to be pushed. And currently there's a bill right now called AB 535, Joint Sawyer Bill, which would allow for ex-felons to sit on juries. And that's a critical piece of legislation, because right now, if you think about it, it should blow everyone's mind that someone who's been convicted of a felony, if it's 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years old, that person, as it is right now, according to the law, they cannot sit on a jury. And that's outrageous. And if we think about the racial implications of that, we know that that's going to exclude about 30%, 33% of African-American men. So there's still a lot of work to do. And if we want to focus on mass incarceration, we want to focus on the criminalization of the poor, we want to focus on the large number of people of color that are in custody, we've got to start attacking the system in multiple ways.
What do you think is the most effective action people can take? Because over the past couple of years, you know, the word reform has gotten so much attention, and these issues are now getting so much more attention. What's most effective on the ground level?
Oh, I think it's a combination of paying attention, voting, being active. There are so many groups that are doing great work, and then partnering with those groups and partnering with legal advocates. But I think the biggest thing people can do is be aware, pay attention, and vote.
Peter, what would you say?
I would say that. I think that we've had a considerable increase in the number of lawyers. There are two pieces here. There are the sort of the professionals and the journalists is very important, public officials. And so I'm really adding, I think the heart of it is what Brendan already said. It's what we haven't had. We haven't had a movement. We're starting, I would say, to have a movement on mass incarceration generally. That's what Prop 47, I think, stands for and needs to happen in other parts of the country. We haven't gotten there in terms of the public having an understanding of how widespread the fines and fees are and how much money is involved and the terrible problems of bail. In terms of public, broad public understanding. But the other part, seeing many more, much more interesting litigation beyond representing individual people, structural litigation, seeing legislation, seeing more journalism, seeing state chief judges, that's all gotten a lot better, but it needs to get even better.
Peter Edelman is professor of law and public policy at the Center on Poverty and Inequality, the Georgetown University Law Center. He worked under the Clinton administration and resigned in protest over the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. His new book is Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Brendan Woods is the first African-American public defender of Alameda County, and he's president of the California Public Defenders Association. Peter and Brendan, thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Turkey's military assault on the Kurdish enclave of Afrin in Syria. We'll talk about the future of the DREAM Act and the San Francisco Board of Supervisors' decision to replace acting mayor London Breed with Mark Farrell. And if you're free tonight, I am moderating a free event called Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. It's a public forum at the Unitarian Universalist Center, 1187 Franklin at Geary in San Francisco. It starts at 7 o'clock. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.